Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is composer and arranger Dennis Dreith. But first of all, composers have been having a problem for a while with the money and the budgets going down, and basically not making what they used to. One of the reasons why budgets have been going down is because most studios and networks feel that the composer really doesn't need an orchestra anymore, or can fake it using samples and using their digital audio workstation. So we find there's less and less money available, and even though there may be more work there in terms of what the composer's doing, they're making less. But now we've gotten to the point where film studios and networks are demanding kickbacks from composers. What that means is they're looking for a percentage of the downstream royalties. Now, the way it works is usually a composer will make some money up front for their work, and then they get paid for the number of times it gets played on television. Now, with a film, for instance, you don't get paid for the number of times it plays in a theater, but when it does go to television, then you get paid for that. Well, now what's happening is the networks and the film studios are beginning to ask composers for a percentage of that money that comes in later on. Essentially, what they're asking for is to share writing credit. On the writing credits, it would be the composer's name as well as the studio or the network's name. Now, there's nothing illegal about this, although there seems that there should be. But essentially, what the networks are doing is they're saying, if you want to work for us ever again, then you have to do this. So they're becoming a big business bully, in effect. This is even happening for production music, in other words, library music, where the network is going to the composer and saying, gee, we'd love to use your music, but you have to cut us in on the downstream royalties. So this makes being a composer even less lucrative and even more cutthroat than it did before. So just imagine if you're a composer and you work really hard to get into a position where finally you're getting big league work, all of a sudden they're coming to you and saying, well, you know what, we're not going to pay you for what you did, and then go to a younger composer who will probably work for that, which sets a precedent which kind of hurts everybody down the line. So obviously this isn't something that's going to work in favor of the composer. It's not something that we want to see, but it's becoming a fact of modern compositional life. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. The second edition of my social media promotion for musicians book is now available on Amazon, iBooks, Ingram, and a bookstore near you. It's the manual for marketing yourself, your band, and your music online, and covers how to use virtually every important online platform for promotion. Also, check out my courses at BobbyOsinskiCourses.com. Now, going to the audio side for a bit, we all love 500 series racks and modules. They're an easy and inexpensive way to get a big sound for not that much money. That being said, one of the downsides is the fact that they're analog. So they have the problem of having to recall them manually. Take a picture with your phone, then recall from there. Well, that may change pretty soon because now there's a trend towards complete control of the 500 series modules via software. And this includes automation, which would be a wonderful thing. There's a number of companies that are actually doing this now. The one in the forefront is called Wes Audio, and they've actually put something forth called the NG500 Rack Initiative. They're using the same 500 series connector on the modules, but it has some additional pins for connectivity, and basically the connectivity is going to be via USB or internet, and this is going to allow the ability to control modules via software. Now, you could download this particular software, put it in your digital audio workstation, connect it via whatever that workstation is, and control the modules from within the workstation. It sounds pretty ideal. The problem is, of course, it doesn't work on modules that haven't been fitted with this extra connector. So this is for a new generation of modules and racks coming up. Now, we're starting to see this happening more and more with newer manufacturers that are getting into this. There's a company called BetterMaker that has memory and recall on their racks and modules. They've had this for quite a while. There's another company called Fredenstein, and they have two different racks, the Bento 10D and 6D. And once again, they allow for recall via USB. And of course, SSL actually has their X-Rack, which allows you to recall via their total recall, but there's no real-time control. It should be interesting to see what happens with Wes Audio and the NG500 Rack Initiative, because I think this is an idea whose time has come, and it's something that everybody would like, because one of the things, that, especially for home studios, is to have a few 500 modules around, and if you can control them from your workstation, it would be just ideal. It'd be something that everybody would want. So look for this to become more prominent in the future, 500 series software control. My guest today is composer-arranger Dennis Dreith, who started in the business playing sax with the Beach Boys, but soon turned to composing and orchestrating for commercials, television, and motion pictures. Along the way, Dennis wrote the scores for cartoons for Hanna-Barbera, movies of the week like Columbo, and motion pictures like A League of Their Own. He also became the go-to orchestrator for the biggest composers in the business, such as John Williams, Hans Zimmer, Jerry Goldsmith, and many more. Dennis actually served as the international president of the Recording Musicians Association for 15 years and served as a consultant and member of the American Federation of Musicians Negotiating Committee. I spoke with him via Skype from a studio in Southern California. Tell me about how you get into this business.
Boy, you know, it's funny. That's a question everybody asks me. My daughter, who's a drummer, and her friends ask me the same thing. And, you know, I think what happens is you make friends at an early age, and you know, you play with those people, you form bands with them, you form friendships, and those relationships are the ones that you forge forever. I had a number of my film students always ask me, how do you break into the movie business? I'd always tell them that they've got great music and they think Steven Spielberg would love them. And I say, no, I'm sure he was, but Steven Spielberg already has John Williams. And so what I tell them is you need to find the people who are going to be the next generation. So if you're a film composer, you need to go out and find the next John Williams. You need to go find not the next John Williams, the next Steven Spielberg. You need to go find each director. If you're really into the record business, you know, it's great if you could get to Mike Klink, for example, but you need to find the next Mike Klink. You need to find the next person. And what I tell people is you go out and you do everything you can. You do their demos, you work on stuff, just hone your craft, and you start out like that, and you build those relationships. This whole business to me, it's all about relationships. So it's about the relationships you build when you're 16, 17 years old are the ones that you nurture through your 20s, and by having your 30s, you know, everybody sort of arrived and you're making music together in whatever genre.
So what happened in your case?
Well, I think that was kind of it. I had a lot of friends. In my case, it was interesting. I was sort of envious. I started playing music a little bit later. I didn't really start music until I was in my junior high school era. And by the time I got to high school, I started playing in different bands. And I had a lot of friends who was interesting, whose parents were studio musicians. Mm. And so I became friends with them. So it was in many cases, some of their parents were the ones who helped me with my first connections. The people who actually, it was interesting because I didn't come from a family of musicians and I sort of envied all those guys and gals who did. But somehow forging those relationships with those players when I was my teens and having the advice of their parents really helped set me on a path. I mean, I didn't really know what kind of careers that were available in music. When I started playing music, I just loved to play music. I didn't know what a studio musician was. I didn't, all I knew is I wanted to play music. And I got pushed in the right directions early on. And then some of the people recommended me for jobs. I remember the first things were playing jobs, going out and doing bus and truck musical, playing woodwinds on them. And I did that. I played saxophone with Paul Revere and the Raiders and the Beach Boys and just some stuff like that. I worked for one time with the Osmond Brothers. All those things that I did like on the road gave me a chance to make a living. And then it was through other friends that I found other opportunities. When I got back off the road, I'd been writing a lot of arrangements for different bands and stuff like that. And a friend of mine was writing for Hanna-Barbera, one of the ghostwriters over there. Recommended me for a job. The funny thing was they were looking for somebody who could do country whole kind of bluegrass score. And of course, I had my whole experience had been R&B and jazz. So when they called me and said, Richard tells me that you're an expert in bluegrass. And I went, absolutely. And not knowing the first things about it. And the first call I made was to a really good friend of mine, a piano player named John Hobbs, who I knew was the maven of country music here in Los Angeles. And so I ran over to John's house really quick and said, teach me some things, some chord progressions and a few licks that'll get me through. And John did that and had me a stack of records, said, here, listen to these guys, check out these chord progressions. Listen, there's a couple of hot licks you can incorporate. And I wrote the first show based on those things and became the expert for Hanna-Barbera for a while. And I became the bluegrass and country specialist.
Tommy Tedesco tells a similar story where they asked him to play flamenco guitar. He knew nothing, but he learned one lick. And all of a sudden he was the expert and would keep on playing that lick over and over, no matter where he was asked.
I'm positive I was on some dates with Tommy when he did exactly that. It wouldn't matter. He'd have one lick that fit. And then he was such a convincing one. He was such a great musician and he was just so convincing in that. And it is funny how that happens. In a similar situation years later, I was working for Universal, writing music for a lot of their sort of utility programs, and I was sort of the backup guy when a score got thrown out and needed something to fill in a hurry. And at one point, they needed some 1920s, real roaring 20s music. Once again, my jazz sort of education started quite a bit after that. And I did a couple of arrangements in that style. Once again, was having a friend. I called up Spud Murphy, the famous arranger who had done all kinds of arranging for Duke Ellington and orchestrated for Billy Strayhorn and had orchestrated and arranged for Ella Fitzgerald, all kinds of people. And was a great guy. Benny Goodman's arranger for years. And I called up Spud and got some advice and made it through my first couple of arrangements and became the hot jazz arranger at Universal for a couple of years. Well, so once again, it's friendship and relationships. And I think that's how my advice to people is you don't want to take an opportunity or take a chance of something you're going to fail at, but you don't want to turn anything down either. And you need to develop some kind of a little bit of a bravery to attack new things, but you also need a safety net. Got to find some people who can help you through.
Did you have any formal training in arranging or in orchestrating, or was it just on the advice of others?
No, I when I was in college, I was a music major at Cal State LA, and I had been a composition major there, and I did study formally arranging and orchestration. Of course, my college days were somewhat odd because I'd moved out of home. My dad and I had sort of a dispute over my choice of careers. And so at 19, I left home basically to make it on my own. And so while I was in college, I really had to also suddenly make a living. So I was going on the road a lot and I wasn't showing up for classes. And I had some great instructors who allowed me to for example, the orchestration class and basic music theory, I became the instructor's grader so I could take papers on the road. I would grade their papers and not show up to class. And I did that. But I also say that where I really got my formal education was in two ways. Like one is when I graduated college, I still felt like that I was sort of lacking. There's a lot of things I didn't know. And there was a great orchestration teacher in Los Angeles named Albert Harris. And he was sort of the orchestration teacher for all kinds of guys doing films and television work. And I went to Al Harris for a couple of years and studied with him. And that's where I honed my craft. And then I was a ghostwriter at Hanna-Barbera for about four seasons. And I think I got to put a lot of that stuff into practice. So that was how I did it with my education.
Well, you were an orchestrator for a lot of great composers. Did that come after you had some success, or is this right in that period?
It was more or less, I guess, after I had a little bit of success. I'd been, doing a lot of TV movies and some other television work. I hadn't had a lot of feature film experience. So it was sort of when I'd sort of, I guess, kind of gotten sort of semi-experienced and at least accomplished, and I actually had a couple of great opportunities. And yeah, I've really had an opportunity to work with some of my idols, you know, in terms of some of the great composers I've had a chance to work with. And I learned something from every one of them. That's where I went to school. You can't help, if you're sitting there orchestrating something for John Williams, you know, and you're looking at that, and you know, a master like that, Lalo Schifrin, Jerry Goldsmith, those guys are these absolute, you know, gods of the business as far as I'm concerned. And you look at that, and these are incredibly gifted and incredibly schooled composers. And you look at that, there's the lesson you can learn from just taking apart their sketches and then recreating those and orchestrating for them are lessons that are incredible. I owe a great debt of gratitude to all the people who sort of, you know, put up with me through those early stages of that kind of stuff.
How long would it take to do an orchestration?
Boy, it's funny. I was having that same discussion with somebody today. And, you know, some of them would just almost write themselves. Especially when you're writing for John Williams, it was pretty easy to, everything's so well spelled out. And it's just, it's hard for me to say. Some things are just like anything else. You look at a piece of music and you can do an orchestration or an arrangement and they're just in a heartbeat, you know, and other days you might just struggle over four bars. I'm on a project right now. There's a jazz singer in town named Kathy Siegel Garcia, who has, you know, a couple of records out and plays around. It's really wonderful. And we're doing an album in a couple of weeks. And I'm working on a couple of the arrangements. Bevan Manson is the producer on this, and I'm taking over on a couple of the arrangements. There's a great Vince Mendoza song called Ambivalence that she's written some lyrics to. And you know, Vince Mendoza is the original recording was with the London Philharmonic. This is a beautifully rich, gorgeous ballad. And it seems like I've looked at this thing, and the music is so wonderful, but it's also quite complex. And that, you know, there might be a place for just a something on a lead sheet might say an E chord, but what's implied is like, you know, raised 11s and flat 13s and all kinds of stuff that's not really there, but you can't really just have a cluster chord. You have to work out these lines. And I spent all day on four bars, literally.
Wow.
And then I went back today and fixed it up a little bit more. And then today I sat down and whipped through, you know, several pages of the same arrangement, in another section. So it's really hard to say. I think it's one of those kind of things where it just seems to take as long as it takes. And of course, deadlines are great enforcers of a schedule. Is that, you know, you can work for 4 days on an arrangement and orchestration, and then a day before a session, you can get three orchestrations that have to be done, and you power through those and you somehow manage to do that. So I just always seem to manage to you know, whatever time is there for it, I use. So it's hard for me to, you know, a lot of guys can tell you exactly how, you know, how many, you know, pages and how many minutes they can write, orchestrate in a day. And I've always been able to get whatever done that I had to get done. But I tend to really go over things and agonize, ruminate on them quite a bit. You know, not that I would put myself anywhere in this category, but there's a great story about a meeting of Igor Stravinsky and Max Steiner. And Max Steiner was reputed to be like an incredibly fast film composer and, you know, a wonderful composer and wrote great volumes. And they were sort of at this cocktail party. And, you know, Steiner was bragging about the volumes of music he'd written the day before, you know, like, you know, went through 20, 30 pages of this, you know, orchestration. And Stravinsky said, huh, really? Thought a minute. He goes, I wrote one bar yesterday. And Steiner kind of laughs. And then Stravinsky goes, but it was a good bar.
When you get a sketch in, does it tell you how dense the orchestration should be in different parts of the arrangement? And the reason why I ask is because obviously, it has to work with film. Are you orchestrating to picture?
Most of the time, yeah, we are, because we want to make sure that the orchestration, you know, that we don't step on dialogue, even though the composer has done his job by trying to write things around it. You know, we certainly don't want to create a, you know, a really thick orchestration that's going to have a lot of frequencies that might have, like, you know, for example, we're not going to put like a, you know, a nice lush flute solo right at the same time a female is given a dialogue, right? They're right in the same register. So we might put a lower string pad or, you know, try to surround those things. And it's different with every composer. Some composers, they're different on each cue. I've had situations with Lalo Schifrin where I've had a very complete, like, eight-line sketch where it was almost, you know, just all I do is copy something. And I've had other times where Lalo's given me a lead sheet and a melody and said, here, you know what to do with this. And in those cases, you look at it, you know, he wrote such a beautiful melody and it works so well that, in fact, I did know exactly what to do with it, you know, knowing him. So it varies from time to time. And especially now we get a lot of MIDI mockups as well. So what happens is you get a model where the composer has sent you, you know, his, you know, a synthesizer realization of what the score should sound like. And our job is then to flesh that out and make it, you know, lusher and, you know, breathe some real life into it, add some dimension to it. And so there's a little bit of a, you know, a fine, in that case, we're really fine tuning, but we have a pretty good idea of what the composer wants, you know, how dense the music is and all those things.
You've composed for film and television and jingles. Which one would you like better? Which one is the most demanding?
Boy, that's a tough question because they all have their challenges. When you're writing for jingles, usually you have to crank out stuff pretty quick. You got a really short burst, you know, and then television is such a tight schedule. You know, we're under really tight deadlines. And then film is like the scope, you know, and of course there we have a compressed schedule. So, you know, I've had easy television shows and really hard shows. I've had easy motion pictures and hard motion pictures. And it's hard to really say that one is more challenging or one is more rewarding. I mean, I actually have found that some of the, you know, lower budget television projects I've done, I've had the most fun and they've been the most rewarding in some ways. And then in other ways is, you know, there's nothing quite like a big budget motion picture with a 110 piece orchestra at your disposal. And in those cases, you just have this incredible palette to choose from. And there's, I don't want to say there's not any challenges, but you have so many choices available where sometimes a project that has a very small ensemble and a very tight budget, you know, produces a different set of challenges. So they're all different challenges to me.
When you say you have fun doing something, what constitutes fun?
Well, some of you might say, how is this fun? You know, you've got this pressure. You have to write something for a 100-piece orchestra and there's a session, you know, 2 days from now. How was that fun? And maybe the sweating part over it. But then, you know, the eyes, you're sitting there and you're writing something, you know that maybe you're going to write a part that a musician is going to sit there. And one, I have to say, and especially in Los Angeles, you know, in New York, you know, other places too, Paris, London, but especially here in Los Angeles, we have a collection of the world's greatest musicians. So as I'm sitting home and I'm writing a line here, and I'm thinking that I'm going to have, you know, arguably one of the best French horn players in the world play this solo. And, you know that they're going to breathe some real life into this part. And that if you can know as you're doing that they're actually not going to not only do that, they're going to make it glorious. They actually might like playing that part. And you want to write something. And when you deliver that and you can hear that on the stage, you hear that music come to life. There's, you know, very few feelings to me in life that are as exciting and satisfying as that. When I was doing cartoon shows, working for Hanna-Barbera, the goal was if I could crack up the band and make them ruin a take by laughing through a take, then I had succeeded, you know? And so, you know, different challenges, but that was fun. I mean, it was hard work. It was grueling work. We had incredible schedules, but the sessions were like hysterical, you know, and you had these fabulous musicians who were just making things as funny as they could, all that kind of stuff. So,
what would crack them up? Just as an example.
Little inside musical jokes, or, you know, you could just turn something, you know, if you're something that's like this, that's funny, you know, that the unexpected, it's like any joke, you know, is all about timing. So if you're going to, you can have somebody where the music takes an unexpected turn, in a completely upside down way, it would be humorous, you know, and there's also humor, you know, you can have funny music, funny sounding music. But to me, it was best as if they didn't see it coming. You know, they're playing through this chart, and it's funny and humorous, and it goes like completely left someplace that they hadn't expected. You know, that's the kind of stuff, like anything, and that's the challenge to do those things.
I saw that you were a consultant for Barbara Streisand for a concert in Las Vegas. So yeah. What does that mean exactly? You were a consultant on the project.
I had a bunch of different jobs on that. Some of it was I orchestrated some of the pieces that we were working on. I had been, by that point, president of the Recording Musicians Association. It was a very complicated contract, so I was there to help them put together the whole deal. There was musicians where we were making a live recording, we were videotaping, we were doing a live concert. So my job was to help coordinate all the different business aspects of that. And I was hired as one of the orchestrators on top of all that. So I wore a lot of different hats in that. And that was a fun project. The band was absolutely fabulous. It was going to be Barbara's big farewell concert. Of course, it turned out to be one of many farewell concerts. But and I'd heard so many stories, about how challenging it is to work for her, you know, and how demanding she is. And all those things are true. But I will say that, and I like to tell this one story. So she had a way of beating up the arrangers, and Marvin Hamlisch was the music director on it, and it was my first experience working with Marvin, so there's very excellent musicians. The musicianship was fabulous. And one of my jobs, we did this big medley of all of her hits, and I was orchestrating that. And what that meant mostly was taking, the great Jack Hayes arrangements and all these different arrangements, putting them together in a medley. And I wrote little bridges and stuff to connect them and all that. I had to write an ending. And one thing, Barbara had me write 5 different endings to people. It was like, because she wanted different things. And we had, it was interesting because we had this one section where I had thought I just had this big ending. I figured by the time we get to the big ending, it would be like this just huge applause and we'd never hear anything more out then. She loved this one ending that Jack Hayes had written for the record. And it has this big ending that comes down to this like little bitty whisper. And I made the mistake of saying to Barbara, Barbara, I really think by the time we get to the concert, we're not going to hear that. And, I think we should just end it big, and I just got this look like, I'm asking you to do this. And I understood, okay, just do what we're told. And, I will say, two things about this. Of course, the night of the concert, the audience went crazy. She couldn't hear anything after the big ending, And so things kind of fell apart. And on the soft section, of course, was all my fault for having been foolish enough to put this soft little thing in there. But the other thing, though, I learned, though, and it was, so it was fun. We just kept doing other endings until we made her happy. And that was my job, was to try to please her. But so as difficult as she could be, the one thing that I learned, and I've kind of always known this, but I really saw it in spades with her, is we showed up to the rehearsal. And there's the orchestra there, and there's Barbara and her entourage and a few friends, a few Hollywood celebrities and stuff like that. But, pretty quiet. She shows up wearing, a sweatsuit and, just kind of like, had jogged in or something. And so a lot of singers, when you're doing that kind of first run through like that, they sort of mouth through the part, they listen to the arrangement a little bit. They, they kind of coast through it a little bit and hum along and, they kind of feel their way. And they kind of save it all for the performance. And so we pass out the parts and the intro plays. And then the first note, there was this unbelievable performance. There was Barbara Streisand giving 110%, from the very first rehearsal. And it made me realize that this is a woman who has only 2 speeds, fabulous or off. Mm. And every time she opens her mouth to sing, it's going to be fabulous. And, it was like a real lesson, to me. It was like, okay, so that's, the mark of somebody who's, who's really successful and real star power to me is that you really, you give it your all. And it was at that point that I just said, she can ask me for anything because she's given 110%. So the rest of us had to as well. And she was infectious, with the orchestra, with all the orchestrators and everything. And it was just, it was fascinating to me. And it was a wonderful lesson, you know, in sort of what it takes, you know, to make it in this business. You know, it was a sort of a, you know, just a metaphor for, I think, what it takes.
You mentioned before about helping negotiate those contracts. You were the president of the Recording Musicians Association for a long time. How did you get into that? Because the business side is definitely different from the creative side, and it's two different parts of the brain. So how did you manage that?
Well, it is, I'd always been, back in my college days, I had been somewhat of a student activist and politically active. And in the case of how it started with the Recording Musicians Association, you know, like many things, I was working for a small jingle house, and the president of the union at the time made some sweetheart deals with another company, and it really decimated a big chunk of our business. And so I was quite angry at the president. It turned out a lot of other people were angry at the deal, and a bunch of musicians just became very active in terms of wanting to take care of, wanting to make the union more democratic, wanting to have a bigger say in our contracts. And it had turned out that there had been a lot of guys before me in the Musicians Guild who had done something just like that in the 50s. And I actually got to meet a lot of those guys, sort of got, you know, sort of politically or unionized, you know, in a way that by them. And it just sort of mushroomed into this organization that was not growth of that. And we started with, a few guys in Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, and Nashville, and that blossomed into an organization of more than 1,000 musicians in Los Angeles and similar numbers in the other cities, smaller in Nashville because it's a smaller community. And New York had a very large chapter at one time as well. So it just kind of grew and just kept growing. And it was really a chance for those who was working in the business to basically have some input into the union. I can't say it wasn't, at first our input was not exactly welcomed in the beginning by our union. But we really, you know, forced the hand and formed this organization and then banded together with similar organizations of symphony musicians and theater musicians. And I think really transformed the union to a much more democratic operation at that point. Of course, that led me, I got to meet a lot of people. I spent a lot of time in the bargaining table, and I got to work with some amazing labor lawyers on both sides of the table and learned a great deal about the business side of things. And ultimately, that left, after I think 15, 16 years, I left the Recording Musicians Association to take over as head of the Film Musicians Secondary Markets Fund, which is sort of our post-60s royalty funds for musicians working in the film industry. And at the same time, I took over this tiny little fund called the AFM and AFTRA Fund before the merger of SAG-AFTRA. And that was in 1999. We had, I think, about $180,000 to make a distribution. And really, only there was started with myself and one other person. And we grew that fund into an organization of about 73, 74 employees and $100 million operation.
Wow.
17 years. And it's been all about statutory royalties and copyright issues. And, you know, position I just left a couple of months ago. I've retired from that. And now I'm going back to work as an everyday musician again.
I'm sure there's a lot of fun in that and a lot of freedom as well.
That's true.
Yeah. I saw that you addressed Congress on intellectual property. What was that like? Because not many people get that opportunity.
Well, it was remarkable. I've always been a little bit of a political junkie. And like I said, I've been active in student politics in my college days. And to really be able to see kind of democracy at work. And I will say that was at a time, I don't want to get on a soapbox here, but that was a time when we had, liberals and conservatives and Democrats and Republicans and people actually could work together. And, there were some incredible people on both sides. I spent a bunch of time during that time working with a congressman from here, Howard Berman, who was a long-term House of Representatives member here. I worked on the legislation with Orrin Hatch. kind of an unlikely pair at the time. When I first met Orrin Hatch, I had this long ponytail and was obviously, you know, not a Republican, and not a Republican from Utah for sure. And I found, nonetheless, he and I really hit it off, and we worked together on this legislation. And so I, you know, at the time I got to make my statement to the to a joint policy committee on intellectual property matters. It was daunting, to say the least, because you walk into a you know, a Senate chamber, and there was Ted Kennedy sitting there, and Dianne Feinstein, and Senator Paul Simon, no relationship to you know, to the real Paul Simon. But anyway, it was a pretty daunting group, and to sit there and have prepared statements, which was the most nerve-wracking part of making my prepared statements. I felt much better when they would ask me questions, and they did. Once they started asking questions, it was kind of just felt like a regular person again. But it was a moment, you know, to sit there and realize that, you know, this is where people have done these incredibly, you know, great things. Legislation has come through there, and like I said, at a time when I looked at this, was, you know, Democrats and Republicans and people just really wanted to do the right thing. I mean, certainly they each had their own agendas. You know, I mean, I remember Orrin Hatch and I having quite a heated debate because he was also proposing some legislation that would protect the flag from any kind of desecration. And while I had always felt that, you know, I felt I was patriotic, I felt that there was, you know, the First Amendment was more important than a symbol. And he and I had quite a debate about it, but it was like this really intellectual but passionate debate. And I really came to like him quite a bit. And so it was interesting just to be able to do that. And I think that, unfortunately, I think it's a time we don't have any longer. Everything has been so polarized. There's nothing but partisan politics. And it was really, I had a final aside to that. We were having some problems on the committee getting, you know, kind of a real compromise. And I was with Howard Berman, and Howard said, come with me. And they were on their way to the chambers for a vote, and pulled me in an elevator with four Republicans and said to them, okay, I want you to listen to him. He said, okay, Dennis, you got 45 seconds. Go.
Wow.
And we rode the elevator down. I gave my spiel, and we actually got a couple of people on our side. And it was really because Howard, the most liberal Democrat in Congress at the time, or certainly one of the most liberal, was trusted by people who were some of the most conservative. But they, you know, he knew, and they knew how to find some middle ground. And, you know, it didn't matter that I was, you know, a Democrat and they were Republicans. I was a constituent, and they wanted to talk to me. And I just don't see that anymore.
Yeah.
And it's a shame.
You know, it's funny. I experienced something similar, but on a way, way, way lower level. I used to own a restaurant in Los Feliz, and we had a beer license, but we wanted to get a liquor license. So we applied, and we had to give a presentation in front of the city council. And of course, we hired a consultant to do that, but I was amazed at how different the language was. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things where it's like, wow, you guys are speaking something foreign. I understand it, but I never would have thought to phrase it the way you're doing it. And of course, they're doing it in the legalese that everyone is used to under those circumstances. But I walked out of there with a new appreciation for anybody that has anything to do with government, because they, again, they're speaking a different language completely than what we're used to.
They are, you know, and it's, but it's, and that, you know, and I found those kind of things that's, to me, stimulating. I thought it was fascinating to try to do that. And I've had some experience with the city council. I would say that's every bit as daunting as a Senate chamber. I will tell you that in some way there's a great deal of power, and the politics on a local level like that are quite fascinating.
So. Yes, we someday after this, we'll talk about that. Tell me about your band, Dennis.
The band. So one of my favorite things. You know, when I was a young guy in my 20s, we had this band together with a whole bunch of guys who were great players. It's basically, I like to say it's not a big band. It's really like sort of a rock and roll rhythm section with a double horn section. It's eight horns and five rhythm. And some of my favorite players in the world are in the band. And but at the time in our 20s, we did this, and nobody had we were all kind of young guys just going on the road and training. And I will say that many years later, all those guys had fabulous careers. If you look at some of the biggest names and biggest records in the world, these guys have all played on this. And we started playing with the band again. So we've been doing some concerts. We have a concert coming up on November 22nd at Catalina. We just finished a CD. And matter of fact, in 2 weeks, there's a reissue of that CD on vinyl for Everland Records, company out of the Netherlands. And it's like, what can I tell you? It's got, you know, great musicians. We've been also doing some, adding some vocalists to it because it's sort of a, you know, it has an R&B flavor, but certainly a lot of improvisation and a lot of blowing. But we just finished doing four songs with Ellis Hall and Tata Vega that I'm really excited about. And so we've had a lot of fun with that. And so hopefully people come out and check it out. It's I'd say it's pretty adventuresome. There's a lot of odd meter things, a lot of room for horn players to play and some great rhythm section players.
Sounds like fun. I have to go check it out.
It is a lot of fun. That is fun. Let's talk about the nothing that's and nothing quite like live music. Having everybody playing live in front of an audience after all the years of doing recordings and everything else, to me, that's still one of the biggest kick in the pants you can have.
Yeah, it's becoming a dying art, unfortunately, where there's so much that has to do with studio magic and trickery, where you have a single player playing to whatever the track was previously recorded rather than playing together. And it's a real shame that it's happening like that, unfortunately.
It is. We had a funny thing. We were at East West. We were in Studio 3 cutting rhythm tracks. And there was a pretty well-known hip-hop group, you know, some urban contemporary guys down the hall in Studio 2. And we had the door open for a while, and almost like come out of the room, there's a bunch of guys standing around there. And one of the guys asked me, like, you know, how we, he hadn't really seen the session. So he you know, loved the groove. And he said, how do you do it? How do you make those beats? How do you make your beats? And it was like, first, I didn't quite understand. It was like, beats. And he said, yeah, man, this is an awesome groove. You know, how did you do that? And I said, well, you know, it's we had everybody in the room together. And, you know, I said, so we had, like, you know, keyboards, bass, drums, guitar, percussion, all at once. And it was like a novel idea. And it was like, really, you can do that? And it was, yeah, do that. It's like, no, it was like, that's how you, you know, it was like, well, how do you control that? And I said, well, that's, you know, kind of that's the idea. You know, there's a little bit of uncontrolled nature you want about that, you know? And, you know, it was interesting. It was like foreign to them. They popped in, they watched the date, and they were just completely blown. I said, come on in. It's like, no secrets, you know? It's like, this is how we do it, you know? And it was like, so hopefully they'll be, you know, maybe they'll think twice about it and decide to try to do some of that. But it was, you know, that's it. To me, that's, if you want to make the magic, that's how you do it.
Yeah, you know, but that's great, because now I bet we'll see some cross-pollinization as a result, because they're exposed to something they were never exposed to before. And I'm sure they'll take that back and they'll start to use it, and suddenly it'll be something cool again. So, hey, you're at the beginning of it.
So, yeah, it comes full circle, maybe. Who knows, you know?
Last question, Dennis. What's the best piece of business advice that maybe you received from somebody, or maybe you learned along the way?
Well, I don't want to say you stumped me, but, you know, because it seems like that it's the business advice always, you know, said, you know, I guess that we have two extremes, you know, and somebody said to me, you know, you got to balance. The best business advice is to balance something. So you don't want to do things for free and be taken advantage of. You don't want to give it away. But you also have to know when it's time to kind of, you know, put it out there. You have to know when it's really wise to have a little bit of a loss leader. And the other bit of business advice I say is, whatever deal you made is the deal you made. And it doesn't matter. You still give 110%. You give 110% if it's the biggest budget project in the world, or if it's the tiniest little budget and you feel that you know, practically gave it away. You still give 110%. So I guess the best business advice is that no matter what the project is, you treat it like it's the most important project in the world. I just maybe one aside and give a little shout out to some of the background singers I work with are the Waters, and I work with Orrin, Maxine, and for ages, and I work with them, and every time they show up for a session, And I know they've done Earth, Wind, and Fire records and worked with Quincy Jones. They work with the biggest names and the biggest stars and the biggest producers in the world. And they show up, you know, they come to my home studio and we're doing background vocals. And for those couple hours that they're here with me, you know, it doesn't matter that, you know, that they just came from a date with Quincy Jones the day before. Today they're there with me and they are giving it all. I mean, and that's the, and what we're doing that day is literally for them is the most important project that they have. And so that's the advice I guess to give to everybody is that whatever you're doing, make it the most important project. You never know where that producer is going to wind up. You know, you don't know where the record's going to wind up. And your performance has to always be the best you can make it. So, you know, it's just, I always think, you know, you just give it that Barbra Streisand 110%. It's, you know, it's kind of both artistic and business advice, I guess.
To find out more about Dennis and his band, you can go to his website, which is DennisDreith.com, DennisDreith, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts to new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.